Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up. Four CEOs of tech giants worth $5 trillion face a reckoning via Zoom in Washington today. I asked critics inside and outside the industry, should Congress rein in their massive power? Then, as the world reckons with the murder of George Floyd, Netflix comedy star Fari confronts a self-proclaimed colorblind culture in France. And later,
it's conceivable, and I say conceivable, that AstraZeneca might be making emergency authorized supplies of the vaccine in October.
Vaccine tracker Carl Zimmer updates us on the state of play in the unprecedented global race for a coronavirus cure. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour, working from home in London. The explosive growth of the tech industry is a great American success story. Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and Google create hundreds of thousands of jobs and rake in trillions of dollars around the world. But today, for the first time, tech titans are zooming together with Congress, which is asking, is big tech just too big? David Cicilline, chair of the House Antitrust Subcommittee, laid out his concerns about their overwhelming power.
Their ability to dictate terms, call the shots, upend entire sectors, and inspire fear represent the powers of a private government. Our founders would not bow before a king, nor should we bow before the emperors of the online economy.
For their part, the four CEOs, Sundar Pichai of Google, Jeff Bezos of Amazon, Tim Cook of Apple, and Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, argue their platforms enhance competition, driving innovation while also helping small businesses grow. Still, there hasn't been an industry reckoning like this since big tobacco bosses were hauled on the carpet back in 1994. And today's blockbuster hearing could mark the end of unregulated growth for the tech sector. Shoshana Zuboff, one of the first tenured women professors at Harvard Business School, is the author and scholar who predicted decades ago the enormous impact that computers would have on our lives. Her latest book is The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. And Tim Bray is a leading software developer who recently resigned a senior post at Amazon over what he calls a vein of toxicity running through that company culture. Welcome, both of you, to the program. So, Tim, since you have just resigned from Amazon, let me ask you first, but I want both of you to reflect on what you've heard so far during the hearings and whether this is the reckoning that is intended. Tim, first to you.
Well, I have to say I'm glad they're happening. And the opening statements by the ranking congresspeople on the committee were mature, grown up, serious, I thought, and very pleasing. It seems like they are taking an adult and considered approach to this. A couple of things stand out. One is that Microsoft isn't there. That seems weird to me. The second is one thing that just stuck out to me is that Representative Sensenbrenner spoke of America's consumers, and conservatives are consumers too. And that attitude troubles me a bit. I would hope that Americans are more than just consumers. They are citizens. They are creators. They are more interesting than that. Having said that, I have some optimism that the committee hearings will move the needle in a positive direction.
So, Shoshana, you've been writing about this for a long time and studying it for decades, as we said. Do you share the optimism that it could move the needle? And I guess, do you share the idea, the question, the fundamental question, that this tech sector is just too big?
Well, I'm glad you started off with that introduction from Congressman Cicilline. When I heard it, I was scribbling down those same words, emperors of the online economy. So here's the good news and the bad news. Are they emperors? Yes. They are the emperors of surveillance empires that exercise total control over the world's information. Unfortunately, none of that is an overstatement. Where Congressman Cicilline understates is that this is no longer constrained to the online economy. That might have been a true statement 10 years ago. Right now, the surveillance economics that has made these once fledgling startups into huge surveillance empires in just 20 years, they have this surveillance economic logic has gone way beyond the online world, way beyond the tech sector, and essentially now is dominating every domain of the conventional economy to such an extent that these empires have indeed become audacious. And their long game, as I really believe it to be, from all these years of study, is that they see themselves going head to head with democracy, undermining and trampling individual rights, and creating a society based on such an extreme concentration of knowledge and the unaccountable power that goes with that knowledge, that it is simply no longer consistent with the aims of a democratic society. That undertaking that challenge, can we create a digital future that is safe for democracy? That's the work that begins today, but it will not end today.
So that is a very dramatic and clearly framed argument against the size and the power of these tech, the big tech four. Tim Bray, you recently, as I said, resigned. You've written an op-ed about it. You've been interviewed about it. You called it a toxic culture running through Amazon. What is the fundamental fear that you have? I mean, colliding with democracy, undermining, the system. Do you agree that it's that toxic? And do you think there's a hope in heck that this antitrust issue can be brought? In other words, can they be broken up?
Well, I would certainly hope so. The classic pattern in antitrust is that some company stumbles into a source of extreme profit. For example, in Google's case, it's web search advertising, which is insanely profitable, and then uses that fountain of cash to invade multiple other sectors and impose unfair competition on anybody else trying to be in that sector. Another consequence of this is that such companies grow very, very large. And as they grow large, their voice grows louder and the amount of power they exercise in the hallways of Washington, where we're watching that hearing, becomes unreasonable. And I think, my particular issue was with Amazon, but I think the notion that there is a completely unreasonable imbalance of wealth and power, not just in the big tech sector, but across the economy, is approaching emergency status. People feel like, they don't count because people like the people who are on display in the committee hearing today are occupying more and more and more of the atmosphere. Big, too big is just a problem at one point. And when you have concentrated ownership of highly profitable businesses, free markets can't possibly work properly. So, yeah, something has to be done. And I think it's perfectly possible to take a reasonably simple legislative approach to stamp out some of the problems that that exist in the, today.
Can I ask you specifically about your issue? You resigned over the way some workers were treated and fired because of complaining about certain conditions. And we see even as these hearings are underway, Amazon is in talks with supermarkets or trying to sort of, get into the supermarket business here in the UK by offering free grocery deliveries and things like that. It's still competing as it's undergoing these hearings. Just quickly about what is the specific issue that you have with Amazon and why you resigned?
Well, the specific issue I had was that there was a debate going on as to whether Amazon was taking adequately good care of the warehouse workers during the time of COVID, and a reasonable debate to have. And there were a certain number of activists inside the company who were arguing that no, Amazon wasn't. And Amazon responded to that by firing them, which struck me as unethical and unacceptable and also not very smart. And for that reason, I left.
Shoshana, let me just turn to you and just summarize some of the main bullet points of the, you know, the sort of the accusations or the problems that Congress says it has with these companies. So Facebook and Google, or Alphabet, the parent company, accusations that they have grown into dominant monopolies, Facebook on social media, Google online search, as you mentioned, squeezing out or buying up their rivals. Apple and Amazon, as we briefly touched on, Jeff Bezos and Tim Cook, will face a similar line of questioning, whether they're abusing the enormous power they have as gatekeepers of their marketplaces. So they're distinct cases for distinct companies. Are there remedies, or what are the remedies that you see, Shoshana, that could apply to each one of them?
Well, Christian, let me just squinch in a little message to Tim. Go, Tim. I'm really proud of Tim and the integrity of his decision, and I suspect there are going to be many more people like Tim who find the moral gap between how these operations work and what democracy requires. That gap is just going to become intolerable. As far as how do antitrust, the tools that antitrust lawyers and lawmakers have to address the harms in these companies, that to me is a matter of some concern. Right in the opening statements, we heard Congressman Cicilline go after the fact that the companies are surveying, they're taking our data. In fact, these companies have become trillion-dollar empires because they steal our private experience. They turn it into data. They analyze it. They produce it. They sell it. That is what accounts for the lion's share of their massive market capitalization. This is a fundamental illegitimacy at the bedrock of the business model of these companies. And if we break them up, let's say we are able to, you know, pull back out Instagram and WhatsApp from Facebook. Let's say we're able to shave off some of those subsidiaries of Alphabet. Let's say we're able to break up AWS, Amazon's cloud business and its retail business. The fact of the matter is, Christian, that simply breaking them up is not going to address the toxic surveillance, pervasive surveillance that is produced by these companies and the way in which it undermines democracies, nor is it going to address the really dangerous and unjust employment practices that Tim is responding to, not only in the warehouses of Amazon, but really across these companies. We've seen Google employees be fired for their protests. We've seen Facebook employees be separated for their dissent and their protests. And so these are the deeper issues. Simple way to think about it. When you think about antitrust, you think about the size of a company and breaking it up, monopoly. That's the container. That's the box, the size. Most of the things we're talking about, and many of the things that the congressman spoke to in their introductions, are not about the container. They're about the contents of the container, the methods, the mechanisms, the policies, the actual ways that these companies make money. And unless we go in there and break up their ability to corner data flows of human-generated information, their ability to corner, to own the infrastructures, the machines, all of the data centers, the servers, the undersea cables, they own all of this. And thirdly, they essentially have a lock on the vast majority of professionals who exist on planet Earth right now, who are specialists in data science and behavioral research, who make the AI go. They know how to turn all those data flows into something meaningful and monetizable. These four companies have a lock on all of this infrastructure and personnel and the data flows. Breaking them up is not going to disturb that. We've got to get inside the box and understand these are unique 21st century challenges that will not be fixed by 20th century law.
So let's take this big example of Facebook. Let me ask you, Tim, Shoshana says it won't be fixed by 21st century law. So how will it be fixed? But let me just put to you this. Obviously, Facebook, some 3 billion people use Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, which are all owned by Facebook, or Messenger, at least once a month. That's obviously bigger than any religion. It's the principal source for so many people bigger than the combined population of the US and China. It's huge, 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 the power. And Mark Zuckerberg has been sort of the boogie boy of a lot of criticism over Facebook, what many people, including Congress and all sorts of other investigations, say is something of a malign influence in many, many domains. He obviously pushes back. What would be your solution to rein in not just the surveillance capital of a Facebook, but the complete and total dominance?
Well, let's ask ourselves why they are engaging in surveillance capitalism and applying ML technologies and so on to using it, artificial intelligence technologies. And the answer, sadly, is to be more effective at selling ads. And one of the monopolies that most strongly concerns me is the joint duopoly that Google and Facebook have over the advertising technology and advertising marketplace. This is immediately, directly, and seriously damaging our intellectual landscape because of the many ad-supported publications that are going out of business, because Google and Facebook have figured out how to be so effective at accumulating data and using it to sell ads that, if you have a really interesting site that is directed at some particular interest, you're probably not going to be able to pay the rent by selling ads. This is terribly damaging and it needs to be fixed. And on this particular case, I agree with Shoshana. Breaking them up isn't enough. We need some radical reforms of advertising technology. I don't want to get all geeky here, but there are things called cookies and third parties and so on, and they are being egregiously, horribly abused at the moment in a way that's very destructive to our society. And yes, once I still think we should break the companies up, but once we've done that, we need to get in there and in particular do radical reforms of the advertising marketplace.
So just to drill down a little bit more, obviously Facebook is very concerning because of its power and what other investigations have said, the power to disrupt elections, inspire sometimes deadly hate campaigns in places, whether it's, Myanmar, India, the like. And by the way, as you know better than I do, Facebook and Google are pouring billions right now today into India, where they think they'll have another, several hundred million consumers. But here's what was written about how it distorts issues like Black Lives Matter. Here in the New York Times, social media once functioned as a tool for the oppressed. In Tahrir Square, in Cairo, Ferguson, Missouri, Baltimore, activists used Twitter and Facebook to organize demonstrations and get their messages out. In recent years, a right-wing reactionary movement has turned the tide. Now, some of the loudest and most established voices on these platforms belong to conservative commentators and paid provocateurs whose aim is mocking and subverting social justice movements. The result is a distorted view of the world that is at odds with actual public sentiment. And, the majority of, for instance, the majority of Americans say they support the Black Lives Matter movement. So, Shoshana, you've already seen some, and you mentioned it, one of the representatives on this panel is already complaining that, it's actually, they're making it political, like their side or the conservative side is being unfairly targeted. How do you even get to a real world regulation of this if it's all mixed up in political sort of victimhood?
Well, these are political questions. There's no doubt about that. But there's so much confusion, Christiane, about what is cause and what is effect. And so this is something that Tim is starting to get at. When we talk about disinformation, or we talk about, you know, the amplification of hate and incendiary messaging, this is an effect. This is not a cause. It's not a thing in itself. What is it an effect of? It's an effect of an economic logic that wants to maximize data flows through the supply chains of these empires. So every single interface that you have with the internet, whether it's your smartphone, or you pass a sensor when you walk through the park, or the camera that's in the cafe where you're having a cappuccino, or the stuff that you've bought because you didn't really know what it was up to that you've put all over your house. All of these things now are interfaces for the supply chains that take from your experience, turn it into data, and drive it into the AIs of these companies. So what they absolutely have to do is they have to maximize those flows. AI needs a lot of data. And so every algorithm that works inside these operations is there to maximize what they euphemistically call engagement, to make it sticky so that you go back and you do more and you spend more time and you press more keys, or you use it to go to other sites, or you use it even to change what you do in your offline behavior, to join a group, to go to a meeting. Now, all of that is every single thing that you do in relation to these interfaces is driving data. And what happens is that if you run into something that's really, you know, provocative, it's like you're driving down the highway, you pass a beautiful elm tree, you keep driving, you drive down the highway and you pass a car wreck, you slow down and the whole field slows down. That's what disinformation is. That's what hate speech is. Mm-hmm. People slow down. They engage more. They are drawn to it. That's the way it works. And when we say about Facebook or Google or any of these companies, it's just business. It's just a business decision. It's true. It is a business decision. In the case of Facebook, choosing not to regulate political ads when they're full of blatant lies, blatant mistruths, that's a business decision that also conveniently dovetails with a political decision, because they have been trying for these last years to be friends with the Trump administration for one simple reason. The only way that these little companies turned into empires in a brief 20 years, two decades, is that there has been no body of law to impede them, partially because lawmakers didn't understand what really goes on inside these companies, but also because lawmakers, starting with 9/11, had a vested interest in having access to the data that these companies were producing. We have lasted for 20 years, kind of democracy being asleep at the switch, watching these companies become hugely dangerous, threatening empires, as Congressman Cicilline implies. And what's great about today, whatever this committee accomplishes, what's great about today is that this is the beginning, not the end, of what promises to be a long and bitter, decade-long struggle over whether or not democracy can reassert control over the digital future. That's where we are right now.
Shoshana Zuboff, Tim Bray, thank you very, very much indeed. And we will keep monitoring this needle and the direction it's moving in. Now, the murder of George Floyd sparked a wave of demonstrations and reflection on race across the whole world, including in France, where protests challenged the culture's idea of itself as colorblind, where everyone is French and no one is black, brown, Asian or white. Which is where the comedian Fari comes in. He's become a global phenomenon, star of Netflix's first French comedy special. He sparked a stand-up renaissance at home in Paris. Take a look at this clip from his latest Netflix special, Hexagon.
Moi, je pense que je suis devenu français vraiment cet été à New York. Parce que je peux finir. Ok. Parce que je sais pas si c'est déjà allé à New York, mais là-bas, dans la rue, ça a vraiment révélé le français et parisien en moi. D'accord? C'est très particulier en tant que français là-bas parce que les gens dans la rue que tu connais pas, ils te parlent. Mais sans raison. Non mais, tu sais, nous, Français, et particulièrement Parisiens, je le concède, il nous faut une vraie raison pour parler à quelqu'un qu'on connaît pas. C'est vrai? Non mais, nous, on parle pas aux gens qu'on connaît. Nous, c'est très simple. Tu me connais pas? Me parle pas. Me parle pas. Et des fois, même si tu me connais, hein, des fois, si, des fois, t'es avec un ami dans la rue, tu dis, attends, c'est un collègue de travail, baisse la tête, je veux pas qu'il me voie. Je veux pas qu'il me voie.
Fahri, welcome now to the program from Paris. So before we get into your shows and talk more about them, I just want to ask you what you are, how you are understanding and participating perhaps in some of the demonstrations, some of the protests, and whether you see any kind of link between racism in the US and in France.
First of all, I think racism, it's racism all over the world. That's the thing about not countries, but about white privilege. So basically the same. And we did protest here because we also have violence, police violence against racial people. And so they often said here in television that US and France, it's very different, but it's the same thing. Because, you know, there's also some violence by police officers because you're black. And we had Adama Traoré, who died exactly the same way George Floyd died, but it was like 4 years ago, and nobody goes to jail until today. So I think that's a global issue, and it's about rethink the way we are about the way we look.
So let me ask you, because you've got a lot of these specials which are creating hits and causing, you know, really popular around the world. In Fahri is the New Black, as one of them is called, you say there are words that French people are scared of. You give an example of white people being scared to say the word noir, which is black in French, obviously. They actually say black in English instead. And as we know, in 2018, your National Assembly remove the word race from the first article of its constitution. Can you explain to an audience why the system is so wary, so reluctant to talk about black, brown, white, you know, Asian? Everybody's meant to be just French in France.
That's a French culture. It's universalism, because they think we should act and be the same way. And also, I think they're afraid about saying those words, because behind those words there is issues and subjects about it. If we say black, like in the French word, that's a big word to them, because it was back then an insult. When you say to someone black, it was something insulting. And so they have to rethink they have to tell the story again, because the story they told us, that's not the story we should listen to when we were a child. And I think that's a big issue for them, because black, it's when they say they exist, they are a community, that's a threat for us. For everyone in France, because we want to see France as just one people, and that's two way of thinking that they think it's opposite, but it's not. We can have community, and we can have people who act like just one people. So they think that if we have a community, it's something dangerous, which I think it's wrong.
You know, that's really interesting, actually, because everybody wants to claim identity. And you know, some people say that if you just talk about being colorblind, you don't value and you don't see different identities. And I think that's what you're saying right now about your own communities. Last year, you caused quite a stir when you greeted the audience at the Molière Theatre Awards, which is like the Tonys in America. You said, "Hello, white people." And on national radio, you've said, you know, France is not anti-racist. You said, you know, tell the truth. I was born here, but you're still terrified. And you've gone viral with those clips online. What is your particular experience? What is the effect, despite the universalism that France adheres to, what is the effect on your real life and your colleagues and friends' real life?
I think here in France, I'm still a young comedian, and I think that's also because of my skin color. And I think that's what I was saying at the Molière. I think white people is also a community, and they don't talk about it. It's like they are the normal way, and there is the others, and that's what I wanted to say when I came and say hello, white people. It's like we see you doing your stuff just between you. So I think if I that's something I don't say often, but I still think if I wasn't black, I would be treated in another way. That's we were talking about this when you asked for an interview. You said you wanted to talk about the amazing career. That's the words we read, the amazing career I had. And I was very surprised, because that's someone from another country who is just seeing that I have a career. And here in France, I'm still seen like a young comedian. And I did a lot of things, so that's my way of experimenting it. But I think people in their lives, in real life, is good. I think I have not a real life because I'm an artist. But yeah, they have struggled to just go forward in their lives because they are seeing like just a black one before being a people. So whenever you want a flag, whenever you want a job, it's way harder than everyone else. And that's the true thing. And people don't want to see that. People don't want to see that we need people that looks like us so we can see and say and think that we can do other things than rappers or soccer players or selling drugs. That's something we need. And I don't see young black people who want to be lawyer or doctors, and that's a shame.
You know, it's really poignant what you said there. You know, we should be looked at as people who are not just X, Y, or Z. But you know that obviously in 2005 there were riots after two young boys were killed when they ran away from police and they were executed. And then a few years later, and twice we've had, you know, majority black, your national football team winning in 98, and then I guess it was whenever it was 2018 or whatever, it was Zidane who was so famous, and then Cillian Mbappe in the latest World Cup, and the whole country comes together to celebrate that. Is there a do you feel there's sort of a, I don't know, is it real, is it slightly hypocritical? How do you feel about that?
No, because soccer it's like it's the same thing than rap. It's we can do that. That's not a problem for them. That's not a danger. So they can accept that the national team is there is black people in it because we win. So obviously that's something acceptable. But it's like I just said, people they don't want to see us. We don't see us as something I'm not saying soccer play is not a good thing, but something higher than that. And that's when we go and protest about police officer, the president said that they are there's no discussion because they use the word separatist. That's like we are a kind of a power, like a secret power, and that's not even a discussion with the police officers, because they after the protesting, they started a protest, the police officers, like if they were the victim, and people are the victim all day long. Yeah, they can protest for something that is true, that everybody sees. And that's a way of thinking in police here in France, because they see black people and Arab people like a threat, and that's the way they talk. When we win the world championship, that's just an event. That's just a party, you know. That's just like the New Eve. Okay, that's not real life. That's
New
like
Year's
a movie.
Eve. Yeah. Well, I hear you. Let me play another one of your clips from the program in June. It's called Faciès, and it's about names and faces. It's sort of about what you're talking about now.
Admettons que je change de prénom. Du coup, est-ce que tu vas oublier que je suis moins clair que les autres prénoms? Genre, si j'ai un prénom plus typiquement français, plus blanc, ton projet, c'est quoi? C'est que je le devienne avec le temps? Ah non, la couleur, pour toi, c'est pas un problème, hein, parce que t'as une amie d'amis qui est plus noire qu'une arabe, excuse-moi. Ok. Et si je change de prénom et que je suis asiatique, est-ce que ce sera plus facile pour toi à prononcer que Granerie? Et si je change de prénom et que je déménage, par contre, est-ce que je devrais rechanger de prénom? Est-ce qu'il y a un prénom un peu passe-partout, tu sais, un prénom un peu agile qui esquiverait ton seum?
Fari, you said rice paddy. It refers to a French politician who called his Asian aide rice paddy. I just want to know, I mean, your comedy is very sharp, it's very pointed. Do you have hope that this moment might change certain things, even in universalist France?
I don't think I will see it. I think maybe our child's child, maybe they will see it, but I don't have a good hope about it, because people don't even, the president don't even see it as a subject. It's not a topic for them, because it's like we always playing as victim. We are not. And we are victims. I'm not, but I'm representing victims, and they don't think that's a real subject, because they don't talk about let's remove the bad police officers. Let's change the way police see Arab and black people. Let's change the way they communicate with people. They should change all the thing, and they afraid of it because it's political. That's just politics, because they don't have
right.
They that's not good for them to change everything because of votes. That's always the same thing.
Well, Fari, thank you so much for bringing your comedy and for your pointed communication, particularly at this time. And
that was
everybody
not
can
that
see
funny,
your specials
but...
on Netflix. Well, it will be if people get to see the whole one, all of them on Netflix and in real life. Thank you. Now, with coronavirus spiking around the world amid easing lockdowns, all the more need for that coronavirus vaccine. In the global scientific rush, Russia is the latest, saying its vaccine will soon be approved, although no testing data has been released amid concerns about cutting corners. Right now, there are more than 165 vaccines in development, and 27 are in human trials. Carl Zimmer is an award-winning science writer with a weekly column in the New York Times. Here he is, breaking down the biology with our Walter Isaacson.
Thanks, Christian. And Carl Zimmer, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's been an amazing past 7 days or so for vaccines, which is what we hope will all save us soon. And with your vaccine tracker in the New York Times, you've done a wonderful job tracking them. Why don't we start with the one that I think may be furthest along, which is the Oxford vaccine. Explain to us where that is in phase three trials and how that actually works. It's a traditional vaccine.
So the Oxford University has a vaccine which they are testing out with AstraZeneca, the drug maker. And basically what it is it's a virus that delivers a gene into your cells. So this particular kind of virus only infects chimpanzees. And so the thinking is that people have not been exposed to this before, so it'll be effective for getting into cells. It can't replicate, though. These kinds of viral vectors are actually engineered, so all they do is just deliver a gene into your cells.
So when it delivers that gene into the cell, what does the gene do?
Well, your cell looks at that gene like any other gene and makes a protein. And this protein happens to be one of the proteins made by the coronavirus. And so when your immune system sees it, the hope is that it makes lots of antibodies that can then go after the real coronavirus if you should get sick.
Most of the proteins being made by any of these vaccines try to mimic the spike protein, right, on the surface of the coronavirus. Why is that?
So the coronavirus has this sort of halo of proteins, and these are called spike, as you say, and they use this protein to latch on to cells in our nose or in our airway and then invade the cell. So this seems to be the best target for our immune system. So people who get sick with the coronavirus and then get better, the reason for that is that their immune system figures out basically how to go after that that spike protein. So the virus just can't get into cells in the first place.
So this Oxford vaccine is in phase three trials. Tell me where it stands and when we might get results.
So this has been going in phase three trials for a few weeks now, in several countries such as Brazil. We'll have to wait and see. Maybe, you know, in a couple months, maybe we might start hearing about results. It really depends on how many people are being exposed to the virus in these different countries. They really don't have that much control over how long it takes before they start to see good results.
So maybe September, maybe October, we'll start getting a first set of results.
It's conceivable, and I say conceivable, that AstraZeneca might be making emergency authorized supplies of the vaccine in October. That's conceivable.
Wow.
Could be longer.
Now, the other two vaccines that in the past week went into phase three trials are one by Moderna and the other, I think, Pfizer is taking the lead on it, maybe with BioNTech. And they do something different. They take a piece of messenger RNA and inject it into your cells. Explain to me why that's different and why it might be better.
So the idea there is that, just to remind everybody of their high school biology, in order to turn a gene into a protein, first your cell copies your gene into a piece of what's called messenger RNA. And that then is used by your cells to make protein. So these researchers have at Moderna, at Pfizer, have been trying out just making a piece of messenger RNA and then getting that into your cells. And then your cells just, boom, make protein out of it. And so there could be potentially some advantages. For one thing, it's a lot easier to make a piece of messenger RNA or also a piece of DNA than it is to take some chimpanzee virus or some other more traditional kind of vaccine, because you're just like dealing with a code. You know, as soon as the genome of the coronavirus was put online, you could just say like, okay, well, there's the gene for the spike protein. Let's just copy out the gene or a messenger RNA version of it, and let's get to work. So that's why Moderna was the first vaccine to go into human testing. It's fast.
And when do you think they'll be getting results?
Well, Moderna and Pfizer, as you mentioned, just started their phase 3 trials. So that could be maybe a couple months. Again, there's a lot of logistics that go into determining when this happens. You got to get 30,000 people or so into a trial. They'll be doing these in many states in the United States. They'll be doing them in other countries as well. And you have to wait and see just how intense the epidemic is. If you've got people vaccinated in a place where there isn't a lot of the virus circulating, it's going to take a long time to see if you've got an effect. So you actually want to go to the places that are most intense. And there you're going to see a difference quickly between people who are vaccinated with a real vaccine and who got the placebo.
I'm in Louisiana and we're pretty intense right now. And I signed up for this trial. Was I foolish to do so?
Oh, no. I mean, it's crucial that lots of people volunteer for these trials. Otherwise, we won't know what works and we can't move forward. So, and we can only, you know, predict so far, like where this vaccine is going to flare up and where it's going to cool down. I mean, that's one of the really amazing things about this pandemic is it explodes, it dies out, it explodes again. So, you know, I'm talking to you from Connecticut. We had a horrific problem here in April and May. Now we're, you know, one of the quietest places in the country for now. We'll see what happens in the fall.
So we talked about the viral vector, the more traditional vaccine, talked about messenger RNA, and you can also do it with DNA. It's about the same. Which of them can be manufactured faster and easier and more cheaply if they come out ahead in this race?
Well, there's actually, a third group of vaccines that, you know, really have the big advantage of just a long track record in terms of experience. That is vaccines that are made out of either a weakened version of the virus you want to vaccinate against or just a killed one. And really that's
sort of like the old polio, Salk and Sabin vaccines.
Tried and true. Yeah. And even today, that's what most vaccines are. There is no licensed messenger RNA vaccine out there for people. None. We mentioned the adenovirus vaccines, like the one that AstraZeneca and University of Oxford have. That is just starting to get approved. There was one that was approved for Ebola, for example, just like a couple weeks ago. They've been in research for years and years and years, but, you know, the vaccine world moves slowly. So, you know, if you want to think about, well, what would be the kind of vaccine that you could just make in huge amounts? Well, you know, actually inactivated vaccines, virus vaccines, or weakened ones, those might be the way to go.
So who's doing those?
Well, places like China. So China actually has two inactivated virus vaccines in phase 3 trials right now. And so, you know, this is really an international story. This is not just the United States doing all the work for everyone. There's stuff going on in China. There's research going on in Singapore, Taiwan, Thailand, just India. And a lot of them are looking at these more traditional ones. The downside there is that it takes longer to scale up. You know, it takes longer to make a big batch of these inactivated virus vaccines, because you have to be very careful about it. You can't rush through it because you want to make sure they're really inactivated.
The United States, I keep reading, has thrown $1 billion here, $1.2 billion there, to help vaccine development, like with Moderna or even many of the others have gotten federal grants. What do those federal grants do? Do they get paid back? And does that mean we'll get the virus more cheaply?
So this has been actually kind of a broad trend recently, because vaccines have suffered a lot from what vaccine makers call the Valley of Death. You know, some scientists do some work on animals. They see that a vaccine has some promise. And then they're like, okay, well, now we need some heavy hitters to come in and help us do the clinical trials and do all the, you know, paperwork for licensing and so on. It's incredibly expensive. And the manufacturing. And a lot of pharmaceutical companies look at it and are like, well, I don't know. Do we think it's going to work? Or are we going to just lose $1 billion on this? That slows things down. And so governments and philanthropic organizations for years now have been saying, we need to find ways to speed up this process for the good of everyone. So one idea is for governments to say in advance, okay, look, we don't know yet if this vaccine is going to work. But if it does, we're going to buy a bunch of them from you. And, you know, we will give you some money so that you're not taking as big a risk on this. And so that you're not going to get destroyed trying to make a vaccine that will help us all.
And if it doesn't work, do we get money back?
Nope.
Okay. Now tell
me. But, you know, the whole thing doesn't work. I mean, if they say like, okay, like you're going to spend all, you're going to put, invest all this and take all this risk. And if it doesn't work out, you give us all this money back. You know, that's not going to work for a lot of businesses.
A lot of the pharmaceutical executives were testifying in front of Congress. Some of them said that they would provide the vaccine at cost, but others like Moderna said, no, we're not going to provide it at cost. And Moderna in particular has been pretty secretive about its approach and has gotten some pushback from scientists. Is there anything that worries you in their approach?
Well, I think in general, we need to be a lot clearer on how everybody is going to get this vaccine. I mean, if we each of us has to pay $100 to get a vaccine, we're not going to get the kind of coverage that we need. And if Moderna says, no, we're not going to do this at cost and won't even tell us what they're going to charge for it, we have a problem. And we do especially have a problem given that that the United States government has been supporting their work.
Are you worried that there is no process and plan for distributing them, for pricing it, for deciding who gets it?
I certainly have talked to a lot of vaccine experts who have been in this business for years who are concerned that we're not reckoning with the full scale of this challenge. I mean, there's a lot of great stuff, again, I should emphasize, in terms of research. The trials are moving forward without sacrificing safety. That's really important. Like we're going to know about the safety profiles of these vaccines and in lots of populations. But you still have that question of how are we going to do something we've never done before? And we need a plan now. And honestly, if you look at, say, where we are with testing, you know, where we're running out of pipette tips, the most basic equipment for testing, that should make us all very concerned about whether we have our act together enough in the United States to do something far more ambitious than widespread testing. Getting vaccines to people as quickly as possible is going to be a much bigger challenge. And if we can't even get the testing right, which we're not, then how are we going to get these vaccines right?
What happens if some people say, I don't want the vaccine?
Well, I mean, there's no plans to make it compulsory. Some people have been wondering if companies will say, in order to work here, you have to get vaccinated. But, you know, that is an important issue because, you know, in order for these vaccines to really be effective on a society-wide scale, we need a lot of people to get them. Because, you know, it's likely that these vaccines are not going to be 100% effective. So just because you get the vaccine doesn't necessarily mean you won't get sick. But if 80%, 90% of people get the vaccine, then it's just going to, the virus itself is just going to become a lot rarer because it's going to have a much harder time getting around. And that's good for everyone.
At-home tests are being developed by various places, Mammoth Biosciences, Sherlock Biosciences. They seem like they'd be transformative. They'd bring biology into our kitchens and they'd let us know instantly how we are. Where do we stand with that, and when can we expect at-home tests?
That's a great question. I mean, I wish it would be like today. I wish, you know, I could hold up an at-home test right here on this camera. It is very frustrating that we don't have things yet, because the tests that we're relying on now use a technology, PCR, which is a great, reliable, powerful technology, but it's old. It's, you know, from the 80s, and it requires a lot of ingredients and a lot of careful fine tuning and such, so that you can't easily run a PCR in your house and on some little device. But as you mentioned, these companies, they're using these new technology, which you know very well, CRISPR, where basically you're using special molecular probes that can zero in on viral genes maybe even just in a spit sample. And, you know, the preliminary studies on them are promising. And that, you know, that sort of thing, a cheap, easy, you know, think of it as like a home pregnancy kit, but for COVID. That would change things so much. You just wake up in the morning, take a test, be like, oh my gosh, I got COVID. I'm not going to work. I'm calling my doctor. We would be so much more on top of this pandemic.
Tell us where your scenario is for how over the next year this movie might end.
I think now, when I think ahead to a year from now, I think that we will have much better treatments for people. So people who do get sick are going to be less likely to die and less likely to suffer lifelong illness. People will be beginning to get vaccinated, so that will help to drive down rates. But, you know, I think we are still going to be making dealing with the virus just a part of our everyday life a year from now. I won't be shaking hands. I won't be hugging strangers. It's just something that we're going to have to be ready to ride through. My big hope is that we take this experience and get ready for the next pandemic now. If we're not looking forward, we're going to get caught again.
Carl Zimmer, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And of course, the world is on tenterhooks about developments there. And finally, the memorials to George Floyd continue 9 weeks since he was killed by police in Minneapolis. His face is lighting up Confederate monuments across the United States. The Families Foundation is teaming up with Change.org to create this 3D hologram, a stunning juxtaposition of black life over the leading defenders of slavery. The high-tech memorial was projected on Tuesday night over the statue of the Confederate Army Commander Robert E. Lee, still standing in Richmond, Virginia, and it will travel to four other stops in North Carolina, Georgia, and other states, following the route of the 1961 Freedom Riders who rode buses to challenge and desegregate public transport and even dining. George Floyd's brother, Rodney, hopes the artwork will, quote, be a symbol for change in places where change is needed most. That is it for now. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.